Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Patients Like Me founder Jamie Haywood. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at a new time management app for nurses. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
One of the directives of the Obama administration's Health Care Reform Act requires pediatricians and health insurers to begin screening kids for obesity, a condition afflicting 1 in 3 American children. The problem? What to do with those children who are identified as being overweight or obese? It's tough enough for adults to lose weight, even with multiple programs at their disposal. There are relatively few programs available to overweight children and their families that aren't expensive or hospital-based. UnitedHealthcare has teamed up with the YMCA to create a program for community-based weight loss sessions for kids and teens, launching the pilot program in Providence, Rhode Island. The kids, accompanied by a parent, join in a group session that are fun, but also informative. Kids are educated about the calorie counts of food, learn about body mass index, and the importance of exercise on a daily basis. At the end of the 16-week program, the overweight kids lost an average of 3.5% of their body fat. And the bonus? The parents and the rest of the family often lost weight too. The pilot program is inexpensive, kid-directed, and life-changing. And with follow-up as part of the program, these kids know they'll still be challenged to keep up with healthy lifestyle changes. Helping kids tackle obesity cheaply and in a community setting that works for kids and their families, now that's a bright idea. Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Jamie Haywood, industrial engineer, founder, and CEO of Patients Like Me, the preeminent online data sharing platform for patients with a variety of diseases. He's also co-founder of ALS Therapy Development Institute. Jamie, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's great to be here.
Jamie, you launched ALS TDI, the first nonprofit biotech company in the world, after your brother was diagnosed with ALS, better known as Lou Gehrig's disease, back in 1998. That quest led ultimately to the founding of Patients Like Me, which allows patients to openly share their medical data for research. You were not a healthcare insider, but you saw the need for an open research model for accelerating therapeutic research. So what is so different about the model you created?
Well, I think from the beginning, you know, I came at this from the perspective of Stephen, which is how do I find answers for Stephen? And with a disease like ALS, where you're sort of given this death sentence of 3 years or so, your primary objective is initially to discover a new treatment, something that delays the disease. And I had this advantage of having an academic father and then working in an institution that was doing basic neuroscience, as sort of knowing some of the strengths and weaknesses of the current system. So, you know, I kind of did what an engineer does, which is to look at the problem and sort of industrialize it and say, what are the ways we need to move forward to find a treatment for Stephen? And that's what led to the institute. And then once Stephen was fairly sick with the disease, we had to manage this very complex disorder at home. And I was realizing that most of what I was learning was from other patients. And it wasn't necessarily just what to do to treat the disease or manage symptoms, but more about how do you live your life with disease well, which I think where the medical system really falls down, doesn't give you that answer. And so Patients Like Me sort of came out of an intersection of that quantitative assessment of disease that relates to discovery, and then this need to understand how to live your life as a patient and have that be quantified and exchangeable and understandable.
So, Jamie, I think that it really was an incredible innovation that you created, because when you started Patients Like Me, there was nothing like it. There was no portal for patients where they could safely and publicly share their medical data and share with each other, with other people suffering from the same illnesses. And I wonder, for our listeners, as we look at this innovation, can you pull the thread? Imagine somebody is getting the news that they have a new and very challenging, difficult problem that they're going to have to live with. How do they find their way to patients like me? What do they do when they get there? And what are these two pathways of both sharing support with other people and experience with other people that helps them live with it, but also sharing their data? What is this data that they share? Maybe you could sort of walk that walk as a patient would today.
You know, let's say that you're mid-30s and you just got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and you have these weird symptoms of pain and maybe some interference in your ability to see and walk. And you have no idea what's going to happen. And you go and you find a great doctor, and you get a second opinion, and you really confirm that you have this process. And maybe they put you on the first-line treatment, and you go home. And the question you ask is, you know, how does this affect my relationship? How does this affect my ability to work? Is it going to get worse? Is it going to get better? Will these problems that I have from taking the drug, these side effects, go away? Or will they get worse over time? And, you know, you probably asked all of those questions of your doctor, and they might have given you pretty good answers from their perspective. But, you know, you're at home, and you just had a fight with your husband because your sex drive is down, and you can't figure out how to connect and relate. And you got to go talk to someone else like you to figure out what's the path. How can you live a great life, even with this problem? And so you start searching, and you find our site. You know, it's not like patients haven't networked and helped each other connect and live, and we've always done that, you know, through churches and through all kinds of social media. But today you can find someone just like you. You can find that 36-year-old woman who was diagnosed 2 years ago, has the same symptoms as you, and maybe is in the same kind of relationship and is struggling with how to be true to yourself and your family. And you'd go through the issues, the dialogue, talk about the consequences of your treatment decisions in that context. And because you're sharing everything, you can find and identify that person. And that's where it really comes out. And it's not like there's one simple value. It's that you're in this deep dialogue with the community, and you don't know what you need to know, and you learn.
So it's not anonymous information. It's you really identify who you are and all sort of aspects of your condition. How is that translated, and how is that helping out improve outcomes for pharmaceutical companies or other researchers who are engaged in clinical research?
There's two parts to that. First off, you don't have to use your name. You can use a username. In fact, most patients don't give their name. But because you're showing so much information, you know, you ultimately, you know, your condition, sometimes where you live, the treatments, you know, we don't want to claim that it's fully anonymous. People don't know who the people are. And if you stay inside the site, you're not indexed by the search engines. And you can learn a lot without even sharing anything. So you can just come and read other people's information. The second part, let's just talk about what the sharing experience is like. You mentioned earlier that it was sort of the ability to share your health records. We actually do more than health records, and I think this is one of the misunderstandings about the health system. When I run a clinical trial and I study a disease or a condition, we measure some really quantitative important things that help us understand what your status is. When you do medicine, you don't actually quantify those things. You take notes, you discuss issues, but the quantification of the health of the patient is only generally done in clinical trials. And so what we do is we do that quantification. So it's actually an outcome management platform, not just a health record. So you really can, just like a trial, know how someone is. And that's what makes healthcare become a discovery tool. Because right now, when a pharmaceutical company wants to know if a drug actually helps anyone in the real world, they have to ask a system that does clinical outcomes research, and that's what we bring, the clinical outcomes research to the practice of medicine through the patient in a collaboration. We find the real value to the patients is through that triangle of formalizing their understanding of their disease, sharing that, and collaborating with their physician to achieve the best outcome, always in a framework that a research enterprise or a researcher, an academic, could learn something from that process of what's your status, what are you doing to change it, what was the result of that?
So the approach to this openness is really intriguing. And yeah, from reading about your work, it sounds like there's still some resistance throughout the established medical community or healthcare community in embracing the model. What's your response when people raise questions of privacy and protecting people from what some have called exploitation of using the patient's data?
This is a complicated issue. it's hard to imagine the difference between our society 7 years ago before Facebook and our society today. You know, we were on the bleeding edge of sort of a new movement, which I would sort of call the community movement, which is to say that we're not all islands. We're not all out living on our own in a hostile world. We want to collaborate in ways to create greater shared value. And I think that the shift from 7 years ago when, you know, doctors were asking us whether it was legal for a patient to share their health information with another patient, and literally asking the question whether it was legal, to today where doctors are actively encouraging people to work on this site, is just a change in our culture. So I believe privacy is a right, but it's not a goal. And I think that we've confounded those two things, that you have a right to privacy, but seeking privacy as a goal is really built on healthy societies. And if we limit the circle of the people we care about only to those that live in our neighborhood, in our house, or in our family, we're going to have a very unhealthy society. When my brother was dealing with ALS, he cared about lots of other people with the disease. He had things that could help them. And the idea that the privacy movement would suggest it was a bad idea for him to do so, really, I think, is just an old concept that's gone. I think that today, these digital tools are allowing people to sort of follow their human instinct to be parts of a community to make a difference. We live in a society that does allow discrimination. And we've used privacy, or sometimes I would say secrecy, as a way of preventing discrimination rather than really fundamentally addressing the question of how do we build a just society that's not based on secrecy but it's based on justice. And that's, I think, the journey we have to go through now, because technology is going to make it so that we can know so much about everyone that if we don't figure out how to live together collaboratively with inequality of conditions and other things, then we're not going to be able to build the just culture we want to live in.
We're speaking today with Jamie Haywood, the driving force behind Patients Like Me, named one of the 15 companies that will change the world by CNN Money. You've also co-founded healthdatarights.org. Really, you've started out with a bold declaration of individual rights in today's social media climate. Talk to us a little bit about that organization and the issues associated with the fundamental right to your health information through all means.
Health Data Rights was actually this wonderful process that I got the honor to be part of. Two of us were sitting and talking about how, as we were trying to help patients, was, you know, not allowed. Like, there are actually 27 states where, as a patient, you are not allowed to get access to your labs unless your doctor gives them to you. The idea that someone have information about you that you weren't allowed to have access to just sort of felt wrong to us in this modern world. And we started talking with more people, and people really said, hey, we really have to write this down. And over about 2 weeks, literally 100 really amazing individuals wordsmithed these very tight concepts, that an individual has a right to a copy of every element of data about their health. And if that data exists in a digital form, in the raw form, like the MRI file or whatever, they must be made available in that form. And it's so simple, but it's not the way the system works. And, you know, I think that we need this to enable patients to be the corrective force in healthcare, the part that makes the healthcare be honest and transparent.
But Jamie, if I could maybe take in just a little bit of a different direction for a moment, the whole issue of the off-label use of medication, of course, patient safety is always a first and foremost concern. And yet there are times when pharmaceuticals or treatments have been developed for one condition, tried in something else, not yet been through all the rigors of all the research to formally give them approval for use in that case, and we call it off-label use. What's the role that your company has played in bringing forward some treatments that maybe have benefit to a subset of people?
A lot of medicine is not actually evidence-based, and you could sort of profile the sort of evidence into sort of two categories with a big gray in-between area. So one is you have these large-scale formal clinical trials where you establish beyond any doubt that a treatment is effective for some population of patients. And medicine operates in that whole gradient. You know, obviously the right thing to do, where if you have the good knowledge, you should do it, and then strong evidence-based. But there's also a great deal in the middle, which is in ALS, one of the treatments is a drug called Elavil that's used to manage excess saliva. And these sort of secondary treatments, which do not have formal indications, I mean, that's a side effect of Elavil is dry mouth, don't have any evidence for them. And so we've done some work in publishing and demonstrating that. And if you go on our website, you can type in a symptom name with your condition, and you can learn all the treatments that patients believe help them with that. And it's belief-based evidence. It's not the formal, you know, actual measured change evidence, though we're developing that. The other thing we've done is look at side effects of medicine. So if you look at two drugs for the treatment of fibromyalgia, one is Lyrica and the other is Cymbalta. They have very different mechanisms, and they've been equivalently established as reducing the pain and fatigue of fibromyalgia. But one of the drugs causes significant weight gain. If you're a woman and trying to figure out what drug to take for fibromyalgia, and your choices are Lyrica and Cymbalta, and you find out that Lyrica will cause you to gain weight every year, you might change your choice or the first choice you make with your doctor. And that information is not obvious, not available. So we've done that as well. So what I'm hoping we can move to is a learning health system where we really do understand that we allow for the development of a treatment collaboratively with the population, not in these sort of formal studies model only, but we observe and learn what happens in the real world, and then the system feeds that back. It's not moral to provide medical care to someone in any real risk situation or any place of ambiguity unless you are collecting sufficient information to guide the next person that goes down that that journey. And that's a pretty radical shift to thinking about how we do healthcare, which is it's only about the person in front of you and you protect their privacy as paramount. But to my mind, if my mom has breast cancer and she does an experimental treatment against her mutation that no one else has done, and that information isn't shared, that's as big a crime as not reporting a crime, because someone else is going to do that and risk their life in the future. And you didn't give them a chance to do that on the best information. And we need to really shift our culture to that new model.
It leads me to wonder, have you observed, whether it was your intention or not, have you observed advocacy groups or action coming out of the community of individuals on People Like Me? Has that translated into testifying in Congress or lobbying on behalf of funding for certain diseases? Anything that sort of transcends what happened within People Like Me into a larger context?
The patients are organizing to evaluate whether treatments work. So in MS, they're looking at CSSBI, which is this sort of surgery that increases blood flow to see if it helps in MS. Same with low-dose naltrexone. People look at diets in fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. And then they're also looking at treatments in ALS across the board. There is a group that are organizing a petition to force the FDA to sort of be more formal about its compassionate access policies. We have this problem where the companies and the FDA and everyone sort of make the right answer impossible. And I think that we need to find through some sort of new, just, moral answers that make a difference there. And I think that we're a platform for that. And then patients just organize together to do specific subtle advocacy issues. They got involved in the stem cell debate, things that really matter to them. And it's fascinating to watch how that plays out, and they organize. We're building new tools to make that more possible now.
Jamie, one of the initiatives to make patient data more accessible is the Blue Button Initiative, which grew out of the efforts of the VA and the Innovation Center for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Talk to us a little bit about that initiative, and why are other data sharing systems not working as effectively?
I mean, I think the federal government has really done a great job of leading here. The VA Blue Button with Peter Levin, mm-hmm. Todd Park, Farzad Mostashari, Anish Chopra have really pushed for and defined this data liquidity in healthcare that's in a really important way, and it's very exciting. I think the reason there hasn't been anyone else that's really hit where we're at is registries really matter, and we're building a lot more of them. The NIH is investing a ton in that. But they're still building them in such a way that they can only allow 20 or 100 researchers to access the database because they contain genetic data, which is essentially fingerprints and identifiers, right? You know, it's a little bit like it's the beginning of the personal computer age. I don't think anyone can really imagine that normal human beings that are not epidemiologists or clinical researchers want access to data. And, you know, when high school students can do genetic studies on disease, we'll live in this different world. And I think the problem is just it's really complicated to leap across that gap. And no one's done it. And so that's why those organizations, PGP, SAGE, matter to me, because they're starting that leap. Oh, and the Creative Commons, which has got an organization called Science Commons that has developed a thing called Open Consent, where if a patient consents, then their data can be used by anyone. You know, I think of the irony of that. Until 2011, there was no document that a human being could sign that would allow anyone in the world to do research on their information. I mean, that's just so insane.
Jamie, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. With all of your hopes and connections, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Sweden has been doing some really amazing work with registries over the last decade. And medicine in Sweden has moved from being sort of this formal research process model to the specialists really operating these registries and collaborating to make the country's health better and every individual with that condition. And the data is amazing. I mean, they're lowering costs, but they're not even trying to do that. What they're really doing is they're just taking better care of people. And this is, you know, things like, how do you manage a heart attack in the hospital? How do you take care of a Parkinson's patient? And that's a model, to my mind, I think, that we help make possible more broadly. You know, a country's wealth is not so much how much money it has, but it's how much health it has. Because health drives everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it drives how successful your children will be in the world economy. We have to start viewing health as a strategic asset and building an economy around healthcare that maximizes that. And if you can get value for health, then we could build a culture where spending more makes you healthier and live longer. My parents are in their 70s. I want them to be here for my kids for a long time. And I want a model that allows me to invest with them in that, making a healthy, fulfilled, a long health span. And that's what I think things like Sweden and registries and platforms like ours make possible.
Today, we've been speaking with Jamie Haywood, founder and CEO of Patients Like Me, the preeminent online data sharing platform for patients with a variety of diseases. Jamie is also the co-founder of the ALS Therapy Development Institute. Jamie, thank you so much for being with us on Conversations today.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this Tech Report. When Dan Keller retired in his 40s from a successful career in IT development, he was able to pursue a lifelong dream of becoming a nurse. That passion led him to an interesting observation. In a growing world of electronic health records, nurses, for the most part, have their entire set of tasks written out on a piece of paper called simply the brain, on which the hundreds of tasks a nurse is responsible for per shift are written out longhand.
And that is the state of the art today, believe it or not. Even though we've got electronic medical records in most of the hospitals, at least that I've worked in, and we have lots and lots of technology, yet every nurse still has that piece of paper, and she calls it her brain because it is. And I looked at that and said, this is crazy.
Keller, who wrote a prototype for the first electronic health record back in the 80s, applied his tech know-how to his new nursing profession. He noticed many nursing tasks simply fell through the cracks with the paper system and developed an app called Nurses Get It Done. The app creates a graphic map of a nurse's shift called the River of Time, in which the hundreds of tasks a nurse must handle on any given day are put into a color-coded timeline in order of importance. It helps them juggle a multitude of priorities, creating better time management, and in the long run, Keller believes, will have a positive impact on the quality of care, something both nurses and the hospitals they work for can get behind.
If the nurse does a better job of time management, she might do a little less overtime. And those overtime hours are really expensive, and they make a huge dent in the hospital's bottom line. And with better time management, we really can make a dollars and cents difference.
Nurses Get It Done is in beta testing now and looks to be a promising tool for nurse care, hospital management, and ultimately patient safety. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this Tech Report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is a Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.